You just give me like a 5 and a 1 or something.
Hi, everybody. My name is Devin. I am an alcoholic. Yeah, thank you so much for asking me to speak. I love the name of the group, Never Too Late. I mean, that is really good for someone like me. So I was maybe under the impression I should pick a topic. So I'll talk a little bit about my story, but I did want to kind of get into a couple of things and read a few things. You know, I'm one of those people that I'm really stubborn, and so I didn't come in out of like, maybe I have a problem. I came in basically on my deathbed. I did not have a suit, and you know, when I came around, I was severely like malnourished. I was like gray skin. I had at one point early on in my like the chaos of what my life was, you know, I thought I was like a tough guy, and I had gotten my teeth shattered with brass knuckles one night, and somewhere in like a blackout I had like cracked, I'd like fallen face first into a table and cracked like the replacement crown. And when I came in, I was actually had a tube of super glue in my pocket, because the tooth would break when I would eat sometimes, and I would super glue it back in and like hold it there and get it so it would stay, so I could keep eating and not look, you know, ridiculous. Although I'm sure that looked ridiculous to watch me do that. And then on the way to actually now where I actually have an actual real front tooth that looks okay, I had gotten a temporary plastic tooth, and I was carrying that around for about a year because insurance wouldn't cover it. So it was like the one that is literally plastic, and they shaved it down to fit it in there. And I was chain smoking cigarettes, and it was like a dark yellow. And so I didn't come in looking like I look today. And at the end of it, you know, I was good for about an hour, if that, you know. And my routine, when it struck me that I could come around to Alcoholics Anonymous again, you know, when I was 18, I got put in like a treatment facility, 28-day program. I had already been accepted to an East Coast college, and I was like, well, I guess I have to go do this program, and I have to look good so that I can still go and do this, you know, I have a scholarship, and I'm going to go to this school. And so I showed up, and I did whatever I was supposed to do, and I'm a quick study. I found out what sounds good in treatment, and I made everybody, the counselors liked me, and I showed up, and I went to meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I did whatever he said. But in the back of my head, I was just, you know, it was just chatter. I just got to do this so I can keep living my life. And then it was a good, you know, 6 years of, you know, almost any kind of like external consequence you could imagine. I didn't have like DUIs. I didn't, you know, there's no like violent stuff going on outside of the home invasion stuff that happened to me. But, you know, ending up in jail, you know, as a result of the home invasion, you know, my teeth were shattered. I got hit in the arm with a knife. I had staples in my head. I like came to in a hospital getting stitched up. And I used and abused everybody that was really around me. And I was like stealing from, you know, local stores. And so I was a thief, I was a liar. And I thought I was like a good guy, and just, you know, I was just trying to manage life. And so when it finally dawned on me, I had been in New York for about a year. And the only reason that homelessness didn't happen in there was that, you know, my family was like, we'll give you a year. You know, you get out of school, we'll give you a year to try to get settled in New York, and then that's it. And so coming up to that year, you know, any money that I ever had, plus like the credit card that went back to them, that credit card was all my food, and every bit of money I had went to like getting wasted. And somewhere I had convinced them to send me the money for the apartment and the bills like at the end of the month, so I wouldn't spend it, so I would actually keep rent current. And so around that summer, it was like maybe late May or something of 2011, it started to dawn on me that like if I didn't have anything going on, I was about to be homeless and unable to pay my bills. And so it dawned on me like, oh yeah, remember there's this recovery idea. And I knew nothing, you know, I hadn't gone to a meeting in 6 years, but along that time, there was just this one guy. I think everyone has like that one person in their life or those couple of people that were somehow connected to recovery. Maybe not everybody, but for me, I had this one guy named Will, and he was from Hawaii, and he was like the happiest guy I'd ever known. And he would walk into a room, and the walls would like expand and come in, and he had this larger than life persona. And I knew that Will had used to like party and get messed up and didn't anymore. And I would call him sometimes, and all he ever told me was, well, hey man, I go to AA, it works for me. And so somewhere in the back of my head, I had this guy's voice of, I go to AA, it works for me. But he never like pushed it on me. He never said, if you want to come, he just said, look, I do this, it works for me. And that really saved my life, I think, because somehow the idea came up that, oh yeah, I could go back to AA. And it was the summer of 2011. I was in Williamsburg. I tried to start going to meetings. And, you know, my nickname was 3-Day Devin. I couldn't get more than like 3 days at most. And then I was back out for a few days and I would come back in. And at this point, I'm an alcoholic. And what I mean is like my mind obsesses over the next drink. But it's also, I'm like an escape artist. So if there was anything in front of me, I was going to do it. So I'm not a specialist. I know some people just drank. I'm here to talk about alcoholism, which is what I want to get into really with the reading in a sec. But you know, I have a broken spirit. And what happened was when I was 13, I started drinking and I found a solution to this broken spirit. And it was, I got drunk, and there was also a lot easier for me to like smoke pot when I was, you know, 13 in the suburbs. So, you know, that was happening. And I felt great and okay with myself and the world. And it was the first time I didn't feel like you were judging me. And I didn't feel like I was judging you. I just didn't care anymore. And so that's kind of why I continued to live this life. So when I, getting back to where I'm unable to really get an hour sober, I started coming to meetings. I couldn't get more than a couple of days. I work in an industry where I go out at night and they give me a free drink ticket so I can go to the bar and get a drink and go, you know, play some music. And that was basically what my nemesis was at the end, was that I would make it through the day. I would try to go to a meeting or two, and then I would go to my gig and I would say, well, it's just one drink. And I just can't have one drink. It never once worked out for me when I was trying to actually not drink or use drugs that I could have one of anything. I always ended up in the same place. And when I look back at my story, sometimes it was over 6 months or a year. But I always tried to stop, or I had these moments of desperation, and I could never stay stopped. And it would start with like, oh, I'm managing. And then I would always wind up back in this place where I'm the most lonely person in the world. And I have all sorts of self-pity, if you only knew. And, you know, I hate everybody else, and I judge everybody else, and I'm better than everybody else. But yet, I'm alone in a crowded room full of people. And that's what it felt for me at the end, was I would show up to the rooms, and I would go to a 1 o'clock meeting in Williamsburg, because I couldn't wake up before noon. And I would go to the 1 o'clock, and by 3 o'clock, almost every day, I was drunk. Or on my way to do so. And the thing that is amazing to me is that sometimes I would feel relief just in making a decision to go and say, well, today is done, I'm just going to deal with this tomorrow. And that's kind of what my obsession looks like, is I wake up and I go, well, I'm hurting today, I got this stuff to do, I got to get out of bed, so I'll deal with this tomorrow. And for 6 years, I tried to deal with it tomorrow. And I've learned by coming in here that it's really like I take certain actions every day that kind of ensure that I'll make it through that day without picking up a drink. So if I was going to pick a topic at all, I really just want to talk about like the common problem and common solution. You know, you hear it a lot, is we have one common problem. And so my common problem is that I'm powerless. And when I look at power throughout our literature, it's always capitalized. And so when I see powerless, what I really think is I'm disconnected from a power. And if I don't have a power, I don't have any way to not drink. And so I wanted to read this one bit, which is, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. And there's a line earlier that really just says, you know, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in my mind rather than my body. And so what I believe my common problem is that I have a mind that's out of control and wants to kill me. And every morning I wake up, and some mornings I wake up and I'm at peace with the world. But more often than not, my mind is already going and spinning out. So I can't really wait to work on that. You know, I used to get up and like go to the bathroom, brush my teeth, start the water for coffee, and I heard a guy say that, you know, I can make life-crippling decisions from the bed to the bathroom. So now I don't even get out of bed before I start this morning prayer and meditation routine. And I have an alarm that goes off, and that is like the alarm goes off, and I instantly start saying the Serenity Prayer, and I instantly try to get to this place where I'm actually connected with what I believe is the solution. You know, what we offer here is really we have a solution. And I can't tell you, like, all I know is that this book is designed to give me a spiritual awakening. If I follow these actions laid out in this program, which I have, I sit here today and I'm free. You know, I've been sober since August 28th, 2011. So I'm coming up on 4.5 years. And in that 4.5 years, I haven't once seriously considered picking up a drink or a drug. And I think that's, you know, in the beginning, that first month, that first 2 months, I didn't necessarily think like that. But with a little bit of time, when I look back, it's like I really haven't seriously considered it. Something happened to me the moment that I gave up that I had any power. So I believe that the most important thing that I have is that I am disconnected from a power. And this idea that my life is unmanageable really for me looks like that internal condition that I find myself in. Because as part of the drugs, you know, I've overdosed, I've had friends commit suicide, I've had loved ones die, you know, I've been in jail, I've sold my body to get money to buy drugs. I pretty much did almost everything that I would think would be like, I'm never doing this moment. And none of those things actually made me go, oh man, I'm an alcoholic. It was the fact that I was miserable and I was depressed and I was alone, even though I had a bunch of friends. I just felt totally isolated from the world. And when I look back when I was a kid, it's a family of four and it's a loving family, but it's the three of them and me. You know, I'm like the black sheep and it was a different situation. So I can kind of follow that pattern of this internal unmanageability that I've had back to like being a little kid. And so when I came in, I wasn't an alcoholic. I just didn't want to die for the first time in my life. And but now looking back on it, it's like by taking these actions, I have had, in the back of the book, they talk about the spiritual experiences, and it's like I've had a shift in perception. And that's really all that we're going at. So if I say God, to me that's a shortcut of trying to explain what has happened in my life as a result of practicing these new actions that before I ever came into AA were completely foreign. And I love that part of, like, I don't have a defense here. I have to find a way to not pick up that first drink. Because once I start, I can't stop. It's like that itch in my back that I can never scratch. But what precedes that is this mental obsession and this insanity that, like, screw it for today, tomorrow I'm going to fix it. And as I said, you know, for 6 years it was tomorrow I'm going to fix it. And I didn't do anything different. And I just kept putting it off and putting it off. And for me, as I said, I came in and it was life or death. So I didn't choose like a spiritual life. It wasn't like I wanted to do that. It was just, I'm going to die, so now I'm willing to listen to what you people have to say. And so I wanted to read this one other part over here. It says, our whole trouble had been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps, and step 3 opens the door. So I kind of wanted to just talk about the idea of willingness, and I wasn't brought to willingness without, as I said, this desperation that I really was about to be homeless and I was probably on my way to dying or being locked up forever. Oh, and as a side, you know, I had pending felony drug charges in Georgia when I was coming around to get sober. So I didn't come in like, all right, let's go. I got a great thing ahead of me. It was like, really, all right, I'm screwed. And all of my plans have run me way past into the ground. And I'm like already digging my own grave. And so I need to have a power. And the biggest thing that the steps have given me is a way to access it in a pretty simple process, right? So I'm asked in step 1 to admit that I don't have the power. And I never came from a religious family. I was brought up without any kind of going to church from like being 4 or 5, like that just stopped. And I've been led to understand that like the action of prayer, whether I believe that I'm praying to this illustrious something or if I'm just talking to the curtains, the action of praying is me saying I don't have the power and I need some help. And so it's kind of just the affirmation that I don't have the power. So when I wake up and I start praying, it's me reminding myself that, oh yeah, I don't have a power until I bring it into my life. And if I look at what is kind of contained in steps 2 and 3, you know, to me it's kind of like a package deal. Step 2 is an overtime process. If I'm willing to come to believe that there's something out there, how that happened for me was I showed up and I heard people's stories and I felt that no one would make this stuff up. So I believed that you weren't lying to me and I was never asked for any money. I was never asked for anything. I was just told to keep coming and I was given unconditional love from the rooms and the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so for me, it was really important that I showed up enough, and I was trying to poke a hole in what everyone was saying, and when I finally was ready, I realized that no one was trying to sell me anything, and that people really did answer the phone if I called, and they genuinely wanted to know how I was doing. And that was a lot more than any of my quote-unquote friends at the time. You know, most of them were just, come to the bar, man. Screw going to those meetings. That's ridiculous. Come with us and get messed up. And then shortly after, they're like, oh, dude, you should probably go home. You're kind of a liability to our party right now. But so I came in here and I found a community of people that really cared about me. And so a lot of my open-mindedness to coming to believe that these people had something was, you know, like finding people like Ivan that has 20-some years sober when I walked in the door and going, wow, man, like, we can connect as people, and I believe that you're not trying to get anything from me, but it seems like you've found something that's working for you. And it also said that, you know, there's this promise that I'll be restored to sanity. And it was posed to me by my last sponsor. It's like, what's the insanity? It's not that I'm like a crazy guy and I do crazy things. It's really that thought, that mental obsession. You know, it's this hopelessness that I get restored from. It's the idea that, you know, somehow I'm going to be able to control and enjoy this experience in my life. And I could try to control it, but I didn't enjoy it. But if I wanted to enjoy it, I was definitely not controlling it. And so I had to like smash the idea that, you know, I could actually drink like other people. And that was part of being restored to sanity for me. And the biggest thing is really I wanted to talk about it and leave as a topic for everybody is the idea of willingness. You know, and for me, like coming into a meeting, whether I'm drunk, just being in a meeting, period, is showing that I'm willing to try something new. Whether I'm able to stop drinking that day or not, like that's the willingness I need to see in somebody. You know, I had a guy call me and I've been talking to him for a while and he's like, I just can't stop drinking. And I was like, can you meet me at 8:30 on my way up to this meeting? And he got on a train and he met me at 8:30. You know, did he stay? He got drunk later that day, but you know, now he's got a little bit of time together. But it's like the willingness is the most important thing that I need to make a beginning. And step three for me was really like, am I willing to actually do steps 4 to 9? That's really all it is. And if you look at the book, it gives us like the step three prayer and these promises. And the next words are like, next we launched on a course of vigorous action, the first of which is a personal house cleaning. So it's been described to me as how do I actually practice a third step is I do inventory and I do a fourth step. But I'm not going to do inventory and a fourth step if I'm really not willing. And I think is again that to me, that came from desperation. That came from me being here because it was a matter of life and death. I obviously wasn't ready to come in before that. And I'm so happy that I see people that come in on their own that aren't there, and they can identify that, like, I have that broken spirit, and I have this mental obsession, and when I start, I can't stop. But they didn't have to experience everything I did. So I bring that up because I'm trying to talk about what alcoholism is to me, and it's not any of the external consequences. It's not the jail. It's none of that. It's really, do I identify that my mind only seems to think about the next time I'm going to drink, and once I start, I don't know what's going to happen. I might be an alcoholic, or you might be an alcoholic, and that's kind of what our book says. And I was convinced that I don't have any power to actually stop this thing. And so that day that I was honest with myself on August 28th, and I basically said, you know, I know if I leave this meeting, I will be drunk or high before the end of the day. That is what is going to happen. Some guys sat me down. They pulled a meeting book out. I ended up at like 4 meetings that day. That was how I made my beginning. I didn't have anything going on. I was fooling myself to think that I had things going on. I just basically detoxed and lived in the rooms. And that was how I started to get some time together. Today, it's a lot different. You know, I'm in a relationship. I live with this normal, beautiful, amazing person who's not an alcoholic. And I only attracted people that were also like me. And at 2 years sober, I met this girl who's like blown my whole world apart. And she does, you know, she'll like pours a glass of wine and leaves it in the other room and like forgets about it. I don't understand how that works. I like go into the kitchen and I pick it up. I'm like, did you want this? Oh yeah, set it down over there. Like I don't attract people like that. You know, I do a lot of service. I'm starting to get more into correction stuff. I do a lot of detoxes and treatment facilities. I'm a GSR for a group now. Although I'm going to be out of town a lot, I'm trying to figure out making it work, and I've got an alternate, and we're trying to figure it out. You know, I do this thing because today, the most important thing is that I can try to give some hope that no matter what you're going through, you don't have to pick up a drink or a drug. So I don't have to do these things. I get to do all this stuff. And in the process in my career, I've gotten to travel the world, and I'm getting to travel the world. And I haven't had to pick up a drink or a drug in 4.5 years. And so the power that exists in this fellowship and in this work is astonishing to me. And I think it's always a privilege to get to come to any meeting, whether I'm speaking or just participating in a meeting. I don't take it lightly. And so far, my life is really, if I tried to write out what I thought my life would be at 4.5 years, I would have shortchanged this by a long shot. So I guess I'd just like to leave the topic with really, it's like kind of steps 1, 2, and 3 are willingness. But if anyone wants to talk about anything, you know, that's fine. But thank you so much for having me, guys.